And could you talk about the when it changed, the grazing changed? Like did you say it was the 40s or 50s when they like they said that this is the only, like they designated areas where people had to graze. That was the 40s or 50s. And
Yeah, pretty much the whole reservation's open to grazing. It's just that there were certain boundaries that people were given to, like, the grazer their livestock in. And so you might have like a couple different boundaries that butt up against each other. So depending on how well your neighbors adhere to the grazing laws and how they follow them. You know, a lot of times you won't have too much problems like out on your range. Like, for example, the way I did it was when my grandmother decided to let me take over the sheep industry, I pretty much left them inside for a long time. You know, deliberately, feeding them hay, make sure of grain, hay, and you know, I would let them out once in a while, but not all the time. Then I started letting them out like once every 2 weeks or something, once every 3 weeks, and then I kept it at that pace for a while just to see how the range would change from what I've seen it to what it is now. And to me, I think there's a lot more diversity that's coming back by doing that. There's a lot more plant coverage in terms of overall total percent cover of the vegetation. And then from what I've noticed too, there's a lot more small rodents that have come back. I mean, one area where there's like an open meadow where I live at, probably like about a mile drive before I get to my corral, there's probably like 10 to 12 different pairs of jet rabbits and cottontails in there. And in that region, you know, it's very rare that we will see like one or two pairs in there. So now there's like 10 to 12 pairs in there. There's all these different kangaroo rats. And see, my view of land use does not just encompass the livestock. See, that's one big thing that people need to take into consideration as well. You know, first and foremost is the wildlife. If your wildlife is healthy, the diversity of the wildlife is healthy, and that like, you have a lot of different types of animals, a lot of different types of mammals, a lot of different types of birds, a lot of different types of raptors. And you're starting to get these big game that are starting to come back into these areas. And once you know that the livestock is healthy and they're doing good, then you know the rangeland is good. Then you start supplementing cattle or sheep into that rangeland slowly. And then over time, you know, you slowly start monitoring how the vegetation changes. Like, what's the grass cover doing? Is the grass cover increasing, decreasing? Is the shrub, are shrubs beginning to look like they're being gnawed down to the nub? So it's really your own personal observation as to how you look at the rangeland. And that's what I did. I made sure that I provided for the wildlife first, and then my livestock. And right now, there's my area is just totally covered with all kinds of vegetation. And when I let out my sheep, if there's no like other families that might be in areas where there's hardly any vegetation, and they'll graze for hours on end, like the whole day. Like, they won't let them out. They'll let them out in the morning and bring them back in the evening. And some families don't even let them in at all. They'll just keep them out overnight, and they tend to get wild sometimes too by doing that. With me, there's so much cover out there. I only graze them like 3 to 4 hours at a time, and they're already full. You know, their bellies get really big, and you know, they get inflated. So I just put them back into the corral. And so I think as a result of doing that, you know, by really controlling my grazing method, I think that's really helped out there at the end. But if you don't control your grazing method, you just keep grazing and grazing and grazing, your diversity, first of all, your diversity goes down. There are species that are really palatable, like there are certain grasses that like gietta grass, you know, the animals really like, you know, those will go down really fast. And then also like certain shrubs that animals will just keep eating, those will go down as they'll become eliminated out of that whole like the total plant community type. And once that happens, I think there's a threshold. Once you go beyond that threshold, there's no coming back to returning to the original community type. Like with sand dunes, there's a threshold there. Like on really good dunes, you know, like the ones that are pretty stable and steady, and they'll have over 25% vegetation cover. But once you hit that 25% vegetation cover due to overgrazing or whatnot, and if it goes below 25%, and then your dune becomes active, your sands start moving again. And that's the case there. You see like in Tuba City, where you actually have active dunes that are starting to move because of too much cattle grazing in that area. You have this one big dune that has moved over and is totally buried at Hogan. It's totally buried two Hogans, one corral, and it's working on its second Hogan, its third Hogan, and it's also working on its second corral. So once you get these dunes that are once stable, and once you get them below like a certain total vegetation cover, then they become active, and then they'll start changing. The same thing with grasslands. Like grasslands, if you have really nice extensive grasslands, and once you get it below like a certain total percent cover, and once like your shrubs start coming in, and then you pretty much have to eradicate your shrubs or try to do something to increase your cover of grasses again. You know, you might have to supplement like reseeding and stuff like that with native grasses. Because particularly like around south of Farmington, you get these real extensive areas of sagebrush. Those in the past were probably grasslands. Because with grasses, native grasses, their roots are much closer to the ground level, up higher to the ground level. And that causes the water table to be much higher as well. But once you get these shrubs that start to take over, like broom snakeweed, or first it goes to broom snakeweed, then it goes to, then maybe rubber rabbit rush, and then to sagebrush, big sagebrush. Once you get these big sagebrush established, you know, like sagebrush will have these big root systems that go way down. So what they do is they tend to draw down the water table, and they kill off all the surrounding plants that are next to it. So all these grasses tend to die off. And also sagebrush from itself, you know, you get the leaves, they produce some type of chemical where it also kills off other plants. So next thing you know, all you get is just a monoculture of just nothing but sagebrush. So you see rangelands kind of slowly changing like that over time. So I think management is really important, like range management, how you manage your grazing, your herding practices, your herding management, I think is really important. And then like I said, the tribe needs to do a whole new reassessment of the rangeland out there. They have to come up with new numbers for people, and maybe even get rid of their old grazing system and just have people pay a fee to graze on the reservation. I wouldn't mind paying a fee. I mean, that'll eliminate a lot of people that aren't there for like to make a living out of it. And like some of the numbers that they give you, they call them like animal unit numbers. You know, like they'll say 4 sheep is equal to 1 cattle or 1 horse. And that's like, that's 4 sheep equal to 1 animal unit of a cow. And when you think about it, when the tribe first brought up these numbers, they probably didn't take into account how long these animals would be feeding. Like, take for example, cattle, they're out there 24 hours a day. Wild horses, they're out there 24 hours a day. And then some families, they herd their sheep more than 8 hours a day. Then like myself, it's only 4 hours a day, 3 to 4 hours a day. So how do you compensate for that time for me to equally like get my grazing rights in there, you know?
Right.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of things that they need to take a look at. And it's either no money, or, you know, there's no interest in it anymore, you know? So, and that's I think it's going to be a big problem there later on in the future.
I think you've answered all of my questions. I have one more question, but if there's anything else that you want to talk about.
Maybe the rare plants might be pretty good.
Okay.
Please. Out here on the reservation area, the Navajo reservation boundary, we probably, our land base is probably at least 2/3, maybe 3/4 of the what we call the Colorado Plateau. And this is a big geologic province. The Colorado Plateau is a big geologic province that kind of looks like a big old kidney-shaped area that's been, it's situated, it's kind of on its own where a lot of the rocks are not really deformed. So you produce these all these different layers that we have here on the plateau. And when you look out into the landscapes, you know, we see all these barren country, barren sandstone, barren clay hills. And from a distance, it looks like there's nothing growing on them. But when you get up closely, you get all these really neat plants that do grow on them. And usually an area that has barren, nothing growing on it, will have something rare on it. Like, just to take, for example, the Colorado Plateau, there was a book that came out about in the year 2000 called Ecoregions of North America. There's many different editors that edited that book. And they're saying that the Colorado Plateau had the highest number of endemic plants out of any other ecoregion in North America. And they gave a rough number of like about 390 species that thought was endemic to the Colorado Plateau. And endemic, it's just another fancy term that means plants or animals or something that's only that only occurs in a small area, maybe in one mountain range, one geologic type, one geographic area, endemic, you know, like the Colorado Plateau. So they said that we have like about 390 endemics. So I took that as a challenge and I started listing all the plants that I knew that were rare, endemic, and endangered and threatened that only occurred on the plateau. So my unofficial list right now is like about 670. So it's almost double what they anticipated. So that really opened up my eyes and saying, yeah, we have a really unique situation here because a lot of it's really controlled by geology, all these rare plants. And that's where my geology came in, where I start studying these different layers just by one layer at a time, the Chin Li Formation, the Owl Rock, remember, the Chin Li, the petrified forest of the Chin Li, the Totodo Formation, you know, all these different layers, specifically just by using the geology, I was starting these different plants. And by doing that, I found out there's a really close association. Like when you have like a geologic rock column, like these fossils, you'll have like the Mancus Formation. There's like a fossils that's associated with the Mancus Formation, and you could actually do that with plants. There's plants that are associated with just the Mancus Formation, with just the Point Lookout Sandstone, with just the Entrada Sandstone, with just the Wingate Sandstone. So it's really neat to find that association of how geology and plants were really interconnected. And a lot of these plants that we consider rare, endemic, endangered, threatened, species of concern, sensitive plants, all these are pretty much specific to a specific geologic layer. And they're all in terms of evolution, they probably evolved within 10 to 15,000 years in time. Because that's probably how things work in terms of land change, you know, like in terms of long-term land change, in terms of long-term plant migration, overall plant community migration, it probably occurs on a level of 15 to 25,000 years in intervals. So that's why it's really hard for us to understand how plants move right now, how it shifts, unless if you really observe it and you have a study site and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So the rare stuff is really unique because they continue to, I continue to find new ones here on the reservation. Like for myself, I probably have like 4 species that are named after me that only occur on the reservation. There's an astragalus called Astragalus cliffordi, Clifford's melt, which it occurs like on barren coal layers. I mean, this is a really hardy plant that occurs on coal. A couple of years ago when there's no other plant that was in flower, it was the only plant that was flowering out. So it grows in harsh conditions, and you throw some kind of drought at it, and it'll still flower in the drought. Mm-hmm. And then I have another plant called Senecio clifordi, Clifford's groundsel from the Chusca Mountains. And then I have another one called Alicia la clifordi, which is Clifford's gilia from the Lukachigay Mountains. And then I have one that I named after my grandmother called Areognum sarahae, Sarah's wild buckwheat. And that's only located from one site, from near Crystal, New Mexico, or yeah, it's Crystal, New Mexico. And so I found out that the Southwest is pretty poorly studied, and you know, by collecting and getting plant specimens from all over the place, I'm actually finding that there's probably a lot more that's out there that still hasn't been discovered yet.